You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org. Welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast about all things theatrical. I'm Deep Tran, your associate editor, and I'm here with
Susie Evans, I'm a senior editor,
and Allison Considine, the editorial assistant.
Our editor-in-chief, Rob Weinert-Kent, is out this week since he got swallowed by a giant wormhole, so we're going to be filling in while he's away.
He's sick.
We're also doing a putting together our December issue, which is about science fiction and theater, and so I'm having Star Trek on the brain right now. My apologies.
Yes, he's been eaten by monsters.
But speaking of print issues, our November issue is on the newsstands right now and in bookshops near you. The theme is access and ability. We had three stories about that in the issue itself, as well as an additional three stories online for a 6-story package that you can find on our website. And the cover story was one about deaf actors in theater by frequent writer Linda Buchwald, and her article was called
Deaf Talent Seen and Heard.
Thank you, Susie. I forgot to flip to it before I started talking about it. All right. And Allison's article, her first print article for us, was called Ready, Willing, and Able, about actors with disabilities being casted for roles that are prescribed for them as well as roles that are not prescribed. So, Allison, do you want to talk a little bit about your research for that?
Sure. So my article focused on the representations of disabilities on stage and whether that was through characters or through the work, plays that have specified characters with disabilities, and kind of looking at the access for those roles for actors who have disabilities. So I spoke to a lot of theater companies that have been doing this. I spoke to a lot of theater companies that are interested in becoming more accessible and kind of broadening their casting resources. And I spoke to groups like the Alliance for the Inclusion of the Arts, a lot of actors who have disabilities. So I got a pretty good broad view about what the situation is for actors who have disabilities on stage.
Another important aspect to think of your article too was parts that are not specified as a character that's not specified as either having like disability or non-disabled, and having parts like that being played by actors of all abilities, right?
Right. I think that was a big topic for a lot of people, is not only just having access to the roles that are defined as having disabilities, but for actors who have some sort of disability to be able to go into an audition room and have the same access as all actors who do not have disabilities, to be up for roles that aren't specified as having a disability. So one of the people I talked to is Michael Patrick Thornton, who's the artistic director of the Gift Theater in Chicago. And he's someone that's been really, his theater company, he's very inclusive with his casting, and he, as a disabled actor himself, really kind of gears towards roles that are, you know, not specified as having a disability, because that's really the only way that it's going to change the game of how people think about casting.
I think it was something he said in your article, or maybe it was someone else, said something about, like, the audience, like, if you see someone in a wheelchair on stage, the audience is like, oh, why are they in a wheelchair? And then if it's not addressed in the play, they're like, oh, but, like, they don't take that away with them when they leave. Because it's like, if it's not important to the story and it doesn't matter what the ability of that person is, why not cast the person who's right for the role no matter where they are on the ability spectrum, I guess.
Right. And there's another theater company that I spoke to, which was Theater Breaking Through Barriers here in New York City. And the artistic director there, Nicholas Viselli, I'm going to say his name wrong, but he was talking about how they recently did a production of Agatha Christie's The Unexpected Guest. And after the show, he did a speech to the audience just saying, like, what their mission is, and that they have inclusive casting, and their company is made up of both actors with disabilities and able-bodied actors. And he said it was funny because a lot of the response he got was like, oh, I had no idea that those four characters were blind, or that one wasn't supposed to be in a wheelchair. So it kind of, I think, sticks with audiences even more when it's not addressed right in the script. And it's a play that, like an Agatha Christie play, where they're maybe very familiar with the storyline, and it just kind of becomes part of it, and it's not the main focus.
And you also talked to Ali Stoker, who's been doing a lot of articles about how she's the first actress in a wheelchair on Broadway. And so we're kind of joking about how you're sharing the cover with Linda, because you both talked about Spring Awakening and how it's redefining roles for these performers who might not have gotten the chance to be on America's Biggest Stage before.
Right. And so Ali Stoker, she's really been kind of getting a lot of attention because she's making everyone aware of the fact that she is on record the first person to be on Broadway who uses a wheelchair, which is pretty astounding that, you know, it's 2015. But Ali is just very optimistic. I'm so glad that I got to talk to her because she's just kind of a role model for younger actors who have disabilities or use a wheelchair to kind of realize that, you know, being in the theater is something that's possible. So she talked to me a little bit about Spring Awakening and how they did need to do some construction to the backstage of the theater.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that, because it's interesting. Most Broadway theaters are accessible for audiences, but there are very few of them, maybe none of them, are accessible for actors backstage if they use a wheelchair, if they use any sort of ADA help.
I think the theater was built in the Brooks Atkinson Theater was like 1926. And I'm sure that the backstage has probably not been, you know, up to code in the last couple of years.
Like most of these stages. Right. And the Broadway studios.
But it's funny because they've never, I mean, maybe not never. I'm sure like guests come backstage to visit friends, but like if Ali's the first performer in a wheelchair to perform on Broadway, this is the first time that's ever had to be tackled in terms of making the backstage accessible.
Right. And Ali said that she was really excited that she didn't have to sit down and have that conversation, that it was just something that the theater was so on board with and knew when she, you know, was coming to Broadway, that it was something they were going to have to address. And they did it without any big hassle. So she has access to the backstage. She has her own dressing room, from what I understand, or an accessible dressing room, and an entrance from the outside into the theater, and she can get around. So she said it's not too problematic.
Yeah, and if you want to find out more about Ali Stoker, you can read Allison's article in our November issue, and we also have a Q&A with her online, too.
Yeah, I think another thing to talk about in terms of our ability and access issue is there's the deaf community does not consider themselves to be considered disabled artists. Deaf is a culture that, in the way that you designated in our article and the way that we've designated our issue, is when you're talking about deaf culture and people that are a part of this culture, it's a capital D for deaf. And when you're talking about someone's like actual hearing ability, then you lowercase it for deaf. But I mean, people who are hearing individuals can be part of deaf culture. Deaf people, lowercase d, cannot be part of deaf culture if they're not part of the culture itself. And so there's an interesting differentiation between Linda's article about deaf talent, capital D, and Allison's article about disabled artists. While she did talk to Michael Arden of Spring Awakening and people like that, she focused more on Ali Stoker and on that sort of access in that article versus the deaf talent, which really is, you know, has really had an upsurge in recent years with productions of Tribes and does Love Person have a deaf person in it?
Yes, it does.
Yeah,
yes.
Aditi Kapil's Love Person and a lot of different productions, which is great. We did want to talk a little bit about, Deep wanted to talk about this, so I guess I'll bring it up. The Seattle Critic, we are all arch journalists here, none of us explicitly critics, as American Theater doesn't do criticism, who posted on Craigslist in the men seeking women section, I might add, seeking dates for his plus one for shows and actually asking the people to pay for the ticket.
And for the
pay half price for the ticket. For those of you who don't know, critics and members of the press are invited to Broadway shows free of charge. They usually get two tickets so you can bring a friend. There's cases where you only get a single, but usually get two. You don't have to pay for these tickets, and it's kind of expected that you bring a friend, you give them the ticket. It's not a profiteering ability, or that's the wrong word. It's not something you can profit from.
It's a courtesy that the theater is doing you by not making you go to the theater alone.
Well, yeah, and people that work in theater professionally, I mean, I know listeners, it sounds like a huge imposition, but going to the theater 5 nights a week alone is, you know, you be really lonely. So
it's really, helps you maintain your social life.
It helps you maintain your social life. And also when you do this professionally, you do go 5 times a week sometimes, and it's nice to bring someone. Anyway, so there's this guy in Seattle who's trying to sell his plus one tickets to women on the internet.
But not only sell the plus ticket, like, it's amazing that he's asking the person to also have their input on what his critique is going to be of the play.
Yeah, he's like, you might get mentioned in my review as my companion.
Yeah. Well, it's almost like that Bitter Lemons thing a couple of months ago where they were charging theater companies to pay them to review their shows. It's getting into that little gray area of ethics where, yes, you are, no one says you cannot do this, but at the same time, it's like an unwritten rule that this is a courtesy.
Well, it's like that Wall Street Journal reporter who wrote that article, that column about how she leaves shows at intermission all the time, and then press reps just stopped inviting her. Because they're like, if we invite you and give you free tickets, we expect you to stay for the whole performance. Which it's another interesting thing. It's a fine, fine line. And, you know, arts journalism is in such a, not the best place right now, particularly critics, even in New York. And so I think, you know, whether it be the theater company paying the critic or the critic trying to make some money off of extra tickets because they're not getting paid enough by their employer, like, none of these seem ethically right. But at the same time, times is tough, my friends.
Wait, so why are you trying to say? You can kind of see why he's doing this?
I can't see why he's doing it, but I think when things get hard, people are pushed to extremes.
Well, there's so many sites online right now, especially in the New York community, and I'm not sure if it's applicable for other communities where the volunteers are reviewing theater and their payment are these free tickets. And so is that enough?
Well, I don't know. I mean, yeah, people volunteer. I mean, blogging killed journalism. The internet killed journalism. I think we can all agree on that. And that there's very few paid jobs, period, whether you're a politics reporter or whether you're a theater critic. And people just want to get their byline out there. And that's why people blog. And that's why people do this. And, you know, with the rise of, you know, online journalism and popular websites, I'm thinking of things like Refinery29 or Politico or The Daily Beast, things that actually, like, make money. But there will always be a 20-year-old college student who wants to get the byline out there who's willing to do it for free. And if you're willing to sacrifice quality in order to not have to pay your writers, and they're happy to get a free theater ticket. I mean, when I was in Chicago in grad school, I reviewed theater in Chicago for free, and the tickets were my payment because I was 22. And that was enough for me. I was in school.
And you're also a student, so you're doing it pro bono. You're doing anything pro bono anyway. But it's not like I'm advocating for this behavior, but I feel like it's part of a question that we're all having right now about how do we fund this really unsustainable form of journalism now, where it, especially in a climate where, you know, like New York Daily News and the New York Post, they laid off their features team. And so the only people left are the critics who now have to, like, bear the brunt of reporting on all culture, not just theater. And so,
and I mean,
a critic wants to make a little bit of money from it. I'm not saying it's an ethically okay thing to do, but what is the alternative?
Well, what the guy in Seattle is doing is completely unethical, and it should not be allowed. But I would also not be surprised to learn if there are critics in New York, maybe not the main STEM critics, but critics in New York who do that. I would not be surprised. I mean, he was kind of dumb to put it on Craigslist. But there's even an insert in the Dames at Sea playbill that asks audiences to review the show on TripAdvisor and Yelp. Like,
yeah,
this
crazy.
Is where we're going with, like, they want to, like, producers want to bypass the critics so that they can just generate audience buzz. And so if the producers don't value the critics' opinions, not that critics work for the producers, they work for their papers.
And if the papers don't value it either.
The papers don't value it either, then where are we going, friends?
Allison, you're the youngest. Where are we going?
I don't know where we're going.
Where are you going to take us is the question.
Yes, exactly. Because I feel like when I was, I mean, we're all in our 20s here. And so when I started out as a journalist, there's all these questions directed at me of, what is the future? And all of these, and all these young people are being so entrepreneurial and willing to work for little money, and they're making, and they are the future of arts journalism, and we're going to survive because they're here. But then at the same time, I've always had the struggle of, yes, us 20-something year olds are still here and we want to do this, but not all of us have cushy staff positions in national theater magazines.
I don't know. I mean, when I was starting out journalism, they were trying to teach me how to program Flash things, and now Flash is dead. So I don't think anybody knows what the future is.
And, well, I had a brain fart earlier. I completely forgot to plug the other stuff in our November issue, such as Brad Rothbart's very searing op-ed that we titled Once More Unto the Breach, about how theater producers should be including more disabled artists as artists in their plays, as actors, as backstage people, as leaders.
It's a big disparity between how many percentage of the population versus how many are represented in the arts. And, you know, if the arts is inclusive, why isn't it being more inclusive? It got a lot of interesting feedback online. I did not read much of it, but I know that there was a heated discussion over it. So if you're curious about the discussion over Brad Rothbart's essay, go to the comments section on AmericanTheater.org and you will have a good time. Also, in our November issue, we have our Theater Facts Report, which is the annual fiscal survey we do of theaters, our TCG's member theaters, and it looks at 2014, and it looks like theaters are doing better. I think some things I remember from the story, which is by Stuart Miller, are individual giving is up. Educational programs are important. So take a look at that. It's a long and dense read, but I think if it's your field, it has some really important information. Other fun things in the November issue, we have a profile of Nigel Smith, who's the new artistic director of The Flea and is directing here at Playwrights Horizons right now, which you'll hear more about, I'm sure, in our recommendation section at the end of this podcast. And there's a profile of a San Francisco-based actor, Ron Campbell. It's a fun issue. So pick it up. It's got a beautiful picture from Spring Awakening on Broadway on the cover, and it's good stuff.
Our next order of business is Susie went to the National Alliance of Musical Theater Festival or showcase, rather.
Yes.
But it's a showcase of snippets from musicals. And so she wrote about it for our website. So do you want to talk a little bit about what you saw? What did you like? I didn't really get that from your article.
Well, my article wasn't a review.
I know, of course not. It was a great overview of this event that not many people know about, but it has launched. The lineup this year had a lot of artists that have had productions at like Chicago Shakespeare and Dallas. And so it's a great showcase for artists in the regions too.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's the National Alliance for Musical Theater, which is a nonprofit organization that has members somewhat similar to Theater Communications Group, which is our publisher. Some of them are nonprofits, some of them are commercial producers, some of them are individual artists. They, every year in October, put together a festival, which is 2 days. It's at New World Stages in New York City, and there are 8 musicals that are presented. They're all billed as brand new musicals. It's rare for them to have had a production before. There were 2 this year, I think, that had productions before. And they get over 200 applications, and you have to apply. And then what happens over these 2 days is that each writing team presents exactly 45 minutes of the musical. Now, it can be 45 minutes from Act 1. It can be snippets here and there. It's really up to the director and the artistic teams. And so the ones that I really liked this year, I loved Noir, which was kind of I guess it was one of the biggest, most anticipated ones of it, because Duncan Cheek wrote the music and Kyle Jarrow, who I spoke to for the article, wrote the book and the lyrics. It was really cool. It's based on film noir, and they used a Foley artist to do a lot of the orchestrations and to do a lot of the sound effects. Whenever I think of Foley artists, I always think of Garrison Keillor's Prairie Home Companion, because I grew up on that, and whatever his name is, Fred. I forget his last name, but he's a fantastic Foley artist on Garrison Keillor's radio show, which, you know. But he didn't do it at NAMM. Someone else did, but it was really cool. Really interesting story. It was kind of about like eavesdropping. The show that was there that had a production before, a lot of productions before actually, was the Q Brothers Othello the Remix. I actually got to write a story about it before I worked at American Theater as a freelancer about three, four years ago when it was at Chicago Shakespeare. It was commissioned by the Globe in London. It's had a lot of regional productions. The Q Brothers, their shtick is they do kind of hip-hop versions of Shakespeare, like totally rapped. Their first big one was The Bombity of Errors, which premiered in New York in 98. So they're not just like jumping on the Hamilton train. They've been doing this for a while. And it's different too. It's definitely rap. It's not like a musical. There's not songs like there are in Hamilton. It's like rapped all the way through. So it was funny for them when I was talking to them about the show because they have done a full production before, and at NAMT, it's a reading. So you have to be at music stands. You have to have your script, and you can't do any choreography. You can't do any staging. Like it's a reading presentation. And they were kind of like, oh, we've done this show before. Like we could do it. And it's a minimalistic show. They don't need a lot of sets. So, they did a little bit of like steps, but they stood at their music stands pretty well. That was really good. I really enjoyed that one a lot. I'm actually going to Chicago in 2 weeks to see their Q Brothers Christmas Carol at Chicago Shakespeare. They're based in Chicago.
And they're a staple at Chicago Shakespeare, apparently.
Yeah, they're amazing.
I actually had a question about one of the productions because I've heard really good things about it, and I also heard the music.
Which one?
On the Eve from, I forget their name. They're a husband-wife composing team.
I really liked On the Eve.
And it had a previous production at Theater 3 in Dallas.
It did?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know. Then there's three productions at NAMP this year that had previous productions. I think Lyft had one in London. On the Eve and Lyft kind of fell into similar categories for me in that I really liked the music from On the Eve. They cut their show into 45 minutes in a really interesting way. They cut a lot of the songs into pieces. And so you'd only hear like 30 seconds of a song. And I'm like, oh, I really like the song. And then it would stop. And I didn't love how the format served their story. I got confused a lot. As an audience member, I didn't follow. And so that was a little bit frustrating, but they had an amazing cast. They had Sarah Stiles, they had Greg Hildreth, they had, Bryn O'Malley, they had really big Broadway stars in there. Eric Anderson was in it, who's going to be in Waitress on Broadway. It was a good cast, and I really did love the music. I felt like it was edited weirdly for the format, but that was not a problem of the show. It was just a problem of the format at NAMT. And I felt Lyft was similar. It was really hard to follow Lyft in the NAMT format, even though I'm sure it sounded like an interesting show.
I just looked it up, and On Eve is composed by Sean and Seth McGill, who have a band called Home by Hovercraft, and they have a couple of albums, so you should check that out. The music's actually really good.
Yeah, the music in On the Eve was good. It was just the way it was cut down was a little bit, gave you kind of like theatrical blue balls. Can I say that?
Yes, I'm keeping that. That's not a curse word, so we're fine. And speaking of festivals, I actually wanted to plug something that I went to because it was really fun. And I saw 12 shows in 2 days at the Without Walls Festival at La Jolla Playhouse. It's a biannual festival every 2 years, and it's site-specific work, primarily outdoors, though there were some inside. It was just one of those experiences where I thought, yes, I'm seeing a boatload of shows, but I don't feel like I saw a lot of shows just because they were so interactive and they included my input and my physical reactions as an audience member that I felt like I was just having fun rather than like having to sit down and be on my best behavior and be quiet, because I did not have to be quiet for most of the shows. And the highlight of that festival for me was Oho, but from Bricklash Production Company in Pittsburgh. And it was an ambulatory show where you were on your feet for most of it and you were blindfolded and you're taking on a trip of sorts where I was helped into a pedicab and then I went to Mumbai. And someone was trying to sell me some chickens, and I didn't have any money, so it was really weird. And then I went to a party, and I danced. There was no alcohol, so that was very unfortunate. It also featured blind performers. And so I had Jeffrey Carpenter, who was in the show and who created and who was the artistic director of Bricolage, to write a piece about making a show about being blind, featuring blind actors, because it's not a topic that's tackled very much in theater. Aside from The Miracle Worker, I don't really know many shows that talk about that experience. And for me as an audience member in that particular show, it made you tap into all of your other senses and made you go through the world as if you were blind and having to depend on other people and having to have someone hold your hand and help you into a cab and not knowing exactly what's going on. That feeling of disorientation, which I don't feel very often in theater. And so that is going to be in my head for a while. And you can read my article about the Without Walls Festival on our website.
And now I think it's a good time to go into our interview with...
Yes, Rob did an interview with Dean Gladden of the Alley Theater. He's a managing director. He came into town for a couple of days and we interviewed him in the office, and he talked about the renovations at the Alley Theater in Houston. They recently completed renovations on their theater, which meant for a season they were homeless.
They had a temporary home at the school, they did at the university.
Yeah. And it also ties into an article that we posted online called A Theater Building Renaissance in Houston by Jessica Goldman. And it talks about how in 2015, 2017, there's 5 theaters going through renovations.
Yeah, there's 5 theaters in Houston. They're all either renovating their current spaces or building new spaces. The spaces are the Alley Theater, Queensberry Theater, Main Street Theater, AD Players, and then there's a new complex of theaters, which they're calling MATCH, which is Midtown Arts and Theater Complex, I think is what it stands for. But it's called MATCH Houston, where a bunch of smaller companies are going to be able to have new spaces to perform in. And so I think it's kind of a big deal that 5 places are renovating. The Alley's the biggest of them. And now let's go to our interview with Dean Gladden.
So I'm here with Dean Gladden, Managing Director of the Alley Theater in Houston, Texas. You're in town for the Leadership U. That's a conference or gathering, convening?
We're actually choosing the finalists.
Oh, choosing the finalists. So it's panel time. Yes, mm-hmm. Okay. And we're here to talk about the Alley has been through a transitional year. Basically, you were off site for a whole season. Tell me a little about that. You're renovating your mid-century brutalist building. Love saying that. Yes. I guess spruced it up inside and out, right? And that required a whole season. That must have been a Herculean effort, not just the renovation, but doing a whole season.
It was.
Off-site. Can you tell me a little bit about that, you know?
The renovation is the first time the building's been renovated since 1968. Wow. And so, it was a massive renovation, $46.5 million.
Right.
And, basically gutting the inside of the theater and, redoing everything below the theater and putting in a fly loft. And so with doing that, we had to, move the season off site, and we're very fortunate. We have a partnership with, University of Houston. And so they allowed us to rent their main theater for a year. So we were there for almost 12 months performing. And it was a challenge in many ways, as you can imagine, doing your productions off-site. But the good news was we were in one location, and to be in one location is a real blessing when you have to do that type of renovation. I know Arena was in 3 different locations over 2 years. And so we were very happy to be in one location in 1 year.
And over 1 year. And then it strikes me with theater, you know, it's opening nights. The schedule's tight and you have to meet it. And
very tight. And the problem that we had, with U of H is that we just were in one theater and we normally run 2 theaters.
Yeah. Okay.
So we had to reduce the number of shows, from 11, down to 8.
Okay.
And so we did 8 shows over there, which is, because we're in one theater, we had to basically run for almost 12 months in order to get those 8 plays in.
Oh, okay. And how did the season go? Did your subscribers follow you? You said it was about a 15-minute drive?
And the university isn't in what's known as the best area of town. And
right.
So we knew that there was going to be a lot of people that wouldn't follow us out there. Mm-hmm. But we did, we made this little video of how you get there and to show that you can do it in about 10 minutes from our current location. Okay. And here's how you do it and literally walk them through it. We had valet parking at the door if they wanted that.
Right.
It worked. Our attendance was outstanding. We exceeded our subscription goal. We exceeded our single ticket goal for out there, which was really terrific. Yeah. And it was a challenge because we had gone from an 824 seat theater to a 565 seat theater. So
okay.
That was a challenge.
And what's the, sorry, 824, and what's the other space?
300.
300, okay. Yeah. And everything obviously went on schedule. You're opening One Man, Two Governors in October.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the construction all came in on budget, so mm-hmm. we'll have spent about $46.5 million renovating the theater, and we'll be ready to go. We're just doing the final touches right now.
Right, and you've obviously budgeted fewer shows for the other space, and you obviously must have budgeted in some shortfall, less revenue, I guess, from ticket sales.
We did. We knew that we were going to lose about $3.5 million in earned income.
Right.
So we had to, basically, when we put together our capital budget, we set aside several million dollars in additional revenue to make up that gap.
Right. Okay.
So we were able to end up the year with a surplus. So we've had actually 9 years of surplus in a row. So we're feeling very good about that.
So tell me a little bit about the building. I've only seen pictures, so I've never been. And it looks a little like a castle. I mean, like a sort of modernist castle. Those turrets around the floor on the side.
Yeah.
Is it pretty much? It looks the same. We would recognize it.
The outside is virtually untouched, other than a fly loft.
Okay.
And so we've replaced the glass with energy conservatory glass, you know, and we've replaced all the lighting with LED lighting. But the exterior has the same feel.
Right.
It feels very much like the alley. We wanted to keep kind of it's a signature award-winning brutalist building.
Yeah.
Willy Franzen was the architect.
Right.
And so we wanted to keep all that character. And so when you go in, you'll still have all that feel and all the architectural elements are there. But when you go in the theater, it's dramatically different.
Oh, really? Really? I mean, so same number of seats, but it's different.
What we've done is we've taken the thrust and expanded the thrust and moved it up four rows and out into the house. And then we've taken the stage itself, and there were actually four pillars on the stage that were holding up the roof that we had to camouflage for every show. So we've eliminated that, put in a six-story fly loft, and so it's a whole new space.
Well, were these downstage or all upstage? Or
well, let me kind of give you the
quotes.
What, because this is, I think, it's kind of interesting. So we went from an 824 seat theater to a 774 seat.
Okay.
If you know the Vivian Beaumont, the new seating is similar to that. We've gone from a fan-shaped amphitheater to a U-shaped amphitheater.
Okay.
And you can pretty much take the Vivian Beaumont blueprint of the stage and put it on top of ours, and that's what you have.
Okay.
The difference is that we've only got 774 seats as versus like 1,300 there.
Yeah,
so
right.
It's very, very intimate.
Yeah.
And, but yet it's a huge stage. The stage has gone from a depth of 40 feet to a depth of 54 feet. It's gone from a proscenium width of 35 feet to a proscenium width of 57 feet.
That's great. That's a huge difference.
And so we had no traps before, so we have the entire thrust and onto the stage is all trapped.
Right.
So we could do, you know, a full orchestra of 40 to 50 people and there if we wanted to.
Right, right.
And then we've got all automated line sets. We have 28 automated line sets. We're one of the few theaters in America that's completely automated line sets.
You gotta explain a line set to me. I don't know what
so, that well, on the fly loft, you have all the lines mm-hmm. that are up in the air that can either hold scenery or lights.
Okay. Okay.
And so they're all computerized. So each line is about 60 feet across and can hold up to 2,000 pounds.
Okay.
And we can move that up about 6 feet a second.
Okay.
And so you can move shows in and out much faster.
Okay.
Or scenery in and out much faster.
So this is going to allow a lot it's more lavish productions at the Alley?
Or? Well, certainly more lavish productions and much more flexibility. So, it took us about 2 weeks to load in and out a show in the old space because of the loading elevator, the freight elevator, was on the center of the stage. It was the worst location you could put one, in addition to having these pillars on stage. So, so now the loading, lift is now on the side stage. So you can load things in while you are performing, and so you can get ready for the next show, which we couldn't do before. So that has eliminated about a month's worth of, freed up about a month's worth of time that we can now perform. So the Alley will basically be performing year-round in the new setup, and we'll be doing anywhere from 15 to 17 plays a year.
Now, it was built as a theater originally?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it was originally built. The Alley was founded in 47.
Yeah.
This theater was built in, and it was, a 200 seat in the round was what it was known for back in the 60s. And Nina Vance was kind of legendary in the field.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, she and Zelda Fischlander were kind of the pioneers during the day.
Yeah.
And then, she was able to get a grant from the Ford Foundation. It was the largest grant at the time from the Ford Foundation that they'd given any regional theater in America, to build this theater. So then it was quite a change from 200 seats to 824 seats and a 300 seat black box.
So I was wondering why it explained some of the weird structural things like the elevator on the stage and the pillars might be vestiges of a different design.
It is vestiges
design.
Of a different time because it wasn't really about scenery back then. It was about the actor in the movie, in the space.
Okay.
And costumes. And so they were not interested in scenery. In fact, I think they wanted to keep it scenery unfriendly to make sure it was never a roadhouse.
That was the concern back in those days, probably. Right? Yeah, definitely. Especially for resident theaters really wanted to make their own, their own work, their own, put their own stamp on things. This is a dumb question. It's not in an actual alley. The name comes from,
The Alley was, when Nina Vance founded the theater, they were looking to name it.
Yeah, yeah.
And, it was literally at the end of an alley.
Oh, it was.
And, so they did a contest and the Alley Theater, won the popular vote.
Yeah.
Nina Vance hated it, but she had to go with it because she announced the contest.
You ask the people, you gotta listen to the people.
There you go.
I was aware, first aware of the Alley, I think back in the 90s when, Corin Redgrave was doing work.
Yes.
And Vanessa. There were, co-productions. In fact, we've got just doing a story about Sherry Parker Lee, who was in Not About Nightingales, mm-hmm. and about how she did it at the Alley and then came to New York and London. Tell me about, how much of your thinking on a national, I want to say Broadway, but I'm just saying on a, how much you think of the Alley as a Houston theater and versus a national theater. Are you thinking about where it sits in that?
Well, obviously, the most unique thing about the Alley is we have a resident acting company. We are the last vestiges of we're the only major urban theater that's got a full resident company that's employed year round.
I did not know that. How big is it?
So we've got about 14 actors.
Wow. I did not know that.
And so that's the most unique thing. I mean, everybody else has pretty much abandoned and gone to a show by show basis.
Yes, sure.
In the country, except for us. And so, that we are committed to that. In addition, obviously our repertoire, needs to be national in scope, and we've, just actually, put together as part of this expansion, a whole new play festival that we'll be doing for the first time, Alley All New, which will take place in February.
Right.
And we have done a number of commissions, Rashid Joseph has done, a number of things from him that we've moved off Broadway. And
yeah, Gruesome Playground Injuries.
Gruesome Playground Injuries
is a play that rings a bell.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. And so we feel a strong commitment to give back to the field. And so you're going to continue to see more new work coming out of the Alley in the future.
Right. I see Liz Frankel from The Public.
That's right.
Your new play.
She's setting up the new play.
The new play program. That's great. There's been a sort of a boom in theater renovation, construction, reconstruction. I mean, and this is Alley's part of that?
Yes.
Yeah.
There are a number of theaters that are being done. Stages, which is a nice small equity house. is getting ready for a major renovation. Main Street Theater is under renovation, right, and their theater and lobby are being redone. AD Players is getting a new theater. And then, a group called Match, which is a Midtown Arts group.
Okay.
They have three theaters that they're building that they will rent out to small theater groups.
Okay.
So, there's a lot of stuff happening right now.
And there's the Queensberry?
Oh, and the Queensberry. Thank you very much. That's the last one. And that's, out of the city center a bit. But out in the Memorial area.
Okay.
Yeah, brand new theater.
And so that's a lot of theater activity. Is there a market for that? Is there a big theater going audience in Houston that really?
There is. It's a continued growing market. And some of the smaller theaters that don't have their own space, that move from place to place, actually have some strong attendance too. So
right.
it's a growing market. The big challenge in Houston is it's so spread out.
Yes.
Houston, the city limits, is the fourth largest city. But it's so spread out that you can put the cities of Chicago, Detroit, Philadelphia, and Baltimore all in the city limits of Houston.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that makes it a little more challenging.
Yeah. That's the wrap on Houston. It's like, I lived in LA for a long time. So it's just sprawl and freeways everywhere. Yeah. Right. Yeah. But there are distinct neighborhoods within that that people. Now, Ensemble Theater, Houston, that's
one. Ensemble Theater is right next to Match. They are literally across the street from each other. Yeah.
So there's a, now is the relationship with the university, was that an ongoing one that went before and after, or do you have a?
We have had an ongoing, we don't have an official school relationship, but we've had an ongoing relationship in that we have taken a lot of their students. Kevin Rigdon, who is our associate artist, teaches there and does all the design work there. So his students come and work. We've had various actors. We've hired a number of actors that come out of their program.
Right.
We've had, you know, young people that have been in our shows. So there is a relationship. Our actors have gone there and taught.
Yeah.
So yes.
Didn't Edward Albee used to live in Houston?
Edward Albee was out there, and we did work with him while he was at the campus as well, yes.
Right. Not anymore, but I know that was one of the peculiarities. I think that was in his days when he wasn't the darling of the New York critics.
That's right.
He went to Houston and did a lot of work there.
Yes.
Are there details that I haven't asked about that you want to tell me about?
What's been really kind of fun for us is we've taken this 1968 building and changed all the amenities. The building originally housed all of our shops.
Yeah.
It housed all of our offices. Now all those shops areas are dressing rooms. We now have dressing rooms for our actors that we can go up to 64 actors.
Okay.
And for dressing room space. We've got we've been able to take the area that was the offices is now a huge bar that overlooks the city.
Okay.
We've taken what was the boardroom and expanded it and offices to two large rooms that we can rent out to the public, or we can use for dinners and seat up to 360 people.
Okay.
So the facility now works very well for us. It has all these amenities that we never had before.
Did the other ones move off site then, the shops?
All the shops are, we own the land that the parking garage behind us sits on.
That big garage.
Yeah. If you've seen a picture of the alley.
Yeah.
So from the 14th floor to the 18th floor, we have space.
Right.
So we have 75,000 square feet, of which we have five floors. And so four of those floors are shops.
Okay.
So costume shop, prop shop, scene shop, everything is up there.
Okay. I knew what I wanted to ask you was just about not just whether there's a good theater market, but it seems Houston in general is booming economically, right?
Houston, well, until the price of oil went down to $47.
Okay. All right.
But Houston, during the recession, you know, everybody was suffering in 2008, 2009.
Right.
But Houston was last into the recession, first out. So it did very well during that time. It's continued to grow. The population's continued to grow. We're seeing almost 100,000 people moving into the area every year.
Right.
But we've really taken a hit this past year. We've seen it in terms of contributions, and we will continue to take hit for another year or so.
Right. Yeah. I'm from Phoenix originally, and they took a huge hit in the housing crisis, especially because that was their main growth.
Yeah.
Was housing and construction, and it seems to be coming back now. The Southwest.
Yeah.
Texas is a really big state. do you feel like Houston first, Texas second, or Texan first?
For me personally, yeah, are you asking?
I'm asking you, Dean.
Well, let's see, I've lived down there for 9 years.
Okay.
And so I guess I'd probably still Houston first, then Texas.
Okay.
So now, I think if you're a native, you're Texas first and then wherever.
So where are you from originally?
I'm from Ohio.
Ohio, okay.
Yeah, I grew up in a small town in Ohio.
Okay. I noticed Jennifer Haley's on your season, and I know she's from, is it San Antonio, around that area? Kate, where's Katie? No, that's near Dallas.
Katie is near us. Katie is
near Houston. Oh, near Houston. Yeah, okay. Right. Well, then she's coming back to her.
Yes, she's from Houston.
Okay,
yes,
well, there you go. Hometown girl.
Yes, hometown girl.
I don't know. She's LA-based now, but yeah, I just... tell me anything more about the season. I know it starts with one of my two governors. I glanced over it. I don't remember the other.
So after that, we're going to do another place.
Oh, yeah, other place. Yeah, with Char White. Yeah, yeah.
And...
all the way.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Which is a great... We're doing it with Dallas Theater Center, which is a nice collaboration. Which
I was going to say, that's the homecoming of that show to Texas, right?
Yeah, it is.
Right.
It
and Robert Shankin...
And he's from Texas. He's from Austin.
He's from Austin. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Is All the Way the kind of show that is just like... Just catnip for your company, right? Your resident company.
Well,
right?
It is. And what's fun is Kevin Moriarty up in Dallas has put together a small resident company. And they're trying to do a resident company like The Alley. And so it's going to be half of their people and half of our people.
Right.
So it starts at The Alley.
Right.
In January and then moves to, Dallas.
Okay.
And it ties into, of course, the presidential library there.
Right. Sure.
LBJ's library and it'll be just really quite an event. It's, I think the second time that The Alley and Dallas have collaborated on a major piece, but it's never been anything this big. This will be a big piece.
That's a big deal. Now, LBJ is is it Lubbock or where's he from exactly? I forget.
You know, I forget what town he's from.
But it's
you
more,
know, of course,
more
he ended up living outside of Dallas.
Okay,
I believe, or maybe it's outside of Austin.
I should know.
I have not visited his house. I think it's outside of Dallas is where he's from.
And there's a for your resident company. There's a talent pool there. I don't know. Is Houston has that commercial market? They shoot TV there. There's enough work for actors.
Well, certainly. Well, we keep the actors. Fully employed.
Well, you keep them employed.
They certainly do some teaching on the side and do some voiceover work. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, so there's something of a market there. I didn't realize that about the resident company because I just came from Oregon Shakespeare, which is, of course, you took me to say the most urban because they're definitely not urban.
Right.
They're kind of
well,
still
and
an exception.
You know, the Shakespeare companies, of course, they've got the full company.
Right.
And when you're a Shakespeare company and you're doing rotating rep, you've got to pretty much
have the same.
But of the urban companies, they pretty much all abandoned.
Urban non-Shakespeare ones, yeah.
Yeah, the non-Shakespeare ones.
An Eternity Rep had a company, but I don't think there's much left of that. There's one in the Midwest, I forget.
All these companies. Well, Milwaukee did.
Milwaukee, that's right, that's the one.
Yeah, and they no longer have one. Yeah, so all these... Kind of a
big ACT, family. I think, for a while brought back about 3 or 4, but I don't know if they do anymore. Yeah, it's tough. The economic pressures. I mean, is that one of the main things that you are?
Well, it's something that we're really committed to, and when we went to the University of Houston, there were a number, you know, based on the shows we were doing, there was time that the actors weren't working. But, you know, for, I think, 3 months out of the year, we paid full salaries to all the actors.
And
so not many theaters would do that.
No, do they come back year in, year out, or they just, it's a renewable every year, that kind of thing, like it works?
They come in and out, but mostly the core has stayed for many years.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
We talked about what you're doing in New York. You said seeing some shows. You're here for Leadership U. Are you here also to look for? I mean, is this the kind of thing Gregory would come to town to look for plays and players?
Gregory usually looks. I mean, obviously, I do as well, but my influence compared to his is much less
over the the program.
Usually, he just wants to make sure I'm seeing what he's looking at and things like that.
Yeah. Great. Well, Dean, I appreciate you coming by. I think it sounds like an exciting. Time for The Alley to go come back home to a newly renovated home.
It's very exciting.
You don't have to live in your home while it's being renovated. That's a nightmare of every
we're thrilled. The new space is going to be pretty phenomenal. So we're inviting everyone to come out and see it. It is really something special.
Thanks for coming by.
Okay, thanks.
And we're back. Hope you enjoyed that conversation that Rob had with Dean Gladden, and make sure you go on our website and check out that article on Houston's theater building renaissance, which is, I think, what they're calling it there. We're back to do some recommendations of shows and things and theatrically related events we have attended or seen or heard about that we think you should know about. So, Deep, do you want to go first?
Sure. I saw a show that we all saw. It's called Here, H-I-R, by Taylor Mack. It's currently playing at Playwrights Horizons, directed by Nigel Smith, whose profile is in our November issue and will be online.
Yeah, the Nigel Smith profile is online, and we also published the play.
And we published the play in December 2014?
Published it in December 2014.
Yes, I was right. Okay. And it follows an Iraq war veteran coming home and to find that his mom has basically upended the house and his dad has had a stroke and his sister is now a transgendered man who goes by the pronoun here. I'm very vocal about how I don't enjoy living room dramas, mainly because they're usually about white middle class issues / secrets / things.
Let
I don't
it be known that
relate.
This play is about the white middle class.
But it's about family going. It's always about family going through some financial issues at Christmas, and someone had an affair, and all that stuff. I really don't care.
All of those things happen in here.
Actually, no one has an affair in here. But here is also about
they are having financial issues.
Not really. The finance is not the main problem in here. It's about the dismantling of the patriarchy and how it affects people on a micro level, because it's revealed that the father who had a stroke, he was very abusive. And now that he's had a stroke, it's enabled his wife to finally have some agency. And so she's decorating the house the way she wants to, and she doesn't have to do anything she doesn't want to do. And it's about what happens to the straight white man when the structures that have kept him in power for so long, when those things are dismantled. And so it was just like I felt emotionally wrecked afterwards, and that doesn't happen to me very often.
It's a very good play, and it's definitely about the dismantling of the patriarchy, but I also think the mom played brilliantly by Christine Nielsen.
Oh, that was a masterful performance.
It was a masterful performance. I mean, she's taken it to the other extreme. Like, now she's no longer beholden to her husband, but she takes that as she's beholden to no one. And, like, the first thing you see of the house is, like, it looks like hoarders. Like, her son, the Iraq war veteran, can't even get in the front door. There's so much stuff piled up in her living room. Like, she has taken it to the extreme.
Why is that a bad thing? Yes, this very traditionally feminine space has been upended because nothing is in the place it's supposed to be. But then why do we need all of this structure? Why is structure so important? Like, why, if she wants to be a mess, why is she not allowed to be a mess? Why is that a bad thing?
Well, I mean, as a single woman who is not beholden to a man at home, I think I would feel, I don't see the fact that I clean up my apartment and put things away as like being beholden to the patriarchy.
Right. But then her son comes home and then he upends the space that she has created for herself. Like, he turns it back into what it was when their dad was still lucid.
He turns it back into what he remembers as his home, and so that makes him comfortable. I don't see that as a patriarchal act. I see that as a...
Oh, I see it as a very violent act.
Patriarchal and violent are not the same word.
It's, yeah, but it was both patriarchal and violent.
I think if I left for college and then I came home and my room had been totally changed to something that was different than my childhood bedroom, I think I would be ravaged and I would want to paint it back and make it back to my childhood bedroom because that's the memory I hold dear.
Well, Allison, I don't want to get into an argument about this with Susie because this might take a while, but what did you think?
I, as an audience member, I felt so relieved when, the son had cleaned up the apartment. I just know, like, sitting there and just seeing the set, it was like just making me feel anxious about it. But there's so much in the play about this switching of, you know, what society says gender roles are. And I just kind of thought it was another point that the veteran who returns home kind of takes on this, what's, you know, the cooking and the cleaning of the household, not so much because it's how his father once had the house, but it was just interesting that he kind of stepped into that role, and it kind of made you examine where the mother was within all of this too. He took over this kind of matriarch role, taking care of everyone and making sure that the finances were okay and cooking. So I don't know.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on in the messy apartment.
The veteran comes in and like cooks, and then she's like, don't cook. Like she's very anti this maternal role too.
Because that's what she's been doing her whole life, and that's what her husband forced her to do, and he abused her when she didn't do it. And so if you're a person going through trauma and this was the state that you were in before, like I think it's very normal for you to not want to be in that state. But then again, my question is like, why did it make you anxious? Just the look of it.
I don't know. I think it was just, you couldn't see, not that you couldn't see all of the set or what was going on, but there was so much going on to look at. And not that it was a distraction either, but it was just like a character could have come out from under a pile of clothes, or it was, I just like wanted to jump on stage and clean up. So when it happened,
the patriarchy talking.
That's maybe, cool. But I don't think it is. I think it's just more of this sense of order, like Susie said earlier.
I think it has to do too with like, it's about the fluidity of gender roles. And so, yes, it's about dismantling the patriarchy, but with dismantling the patriarchy, I think Christine Nielsen's character, like at the beginning, takes it to an extreme where she completely abandons all duties, completely all responsibility, all duties, and just doesn't.
Well, not all duties. She's homeschooling his brother
though? There's never a scene where they're actually homeschooling.
Because he came home for a total of, what, 4 hours?
I think they're talking about all terms of gender. The fact that the veteran is doing the quote unquote matriarchal role, and the fact that the mother has like completely abandoned all roles in society. Like it's about where do you fall in the spectrum? I mean, you can't not do anything. You have to do something. And so like that's just the structure of the world. That has nothing to do with gender. That just has to do with functioning as a human being. And so how do you like, I mean,
it's not like they're squatters though. They go on vacation.
They are squatters.
Well, no, they go on vacation and they go to art galleries and they're learning about each other and about transitioning. And so I don't really think just because their house is messy and filled with, you know, butterfly stickers, that doesn't mean that they're not doing anything.
I think that, you know, why do we think hoarders have a problem?
But she wasn't hoarding. It wasn't like it was floor to ceiling trash. They're also doing shadow puppetry. You know, it's just like another way of living.
Well, then maybe I don't think that way of living has anything to do with gender. That's what I'm saying. I think that it makes me uncomfortable, was messy. I don't view my need to like keep my apartment clean as like a gender role. I view it as like a way that human beings are quote unquote supposed to live. So maybe that's different, but I don't think it has anything to do with gender.
I don't think cleaning is gendered as a concept, but I do think to that character, it was gendered. It was something that she was forced to do as a wife because she couldn't get a job before when her husband was still around. And so
she doesn't have a job now.
She has a job now. She's at a non-for-profit. They talked very specifically about how her son considers her like an Avon lady type.
So what does it mean to you when the Iraq vet starts doing all the cleaning and cooking?
He's invading her space and
even
the
though
space
she doesn't want
built for, huh?
Even though she doesn't want to clean and cook.
Exactly, because those things are traumatic for her, and she's dealing with this very real trauma of what happened to her in her relationship with her husband in the only way that she can. And then, and then he goes in and doesn't really consider why the house is the way it is. The only thing that he can do is to just block everything out and make it go back to the way it was before, and not acknowledging that some violent things have happened, and so we need to move through this and not ignore it.
Yeah. I don't agree. I think there's a lot of other things to it. Why don't you go next, Allison?
Yeah.
Okay. As I'm having a coughing fit over here. Well, I saw Here this week, so I'm just going to put it out there that you should see it. But non-theater related, I've been reading The Hound of the Baskervilles, which is a Sherlock Holmes novel by Arthur Conan Doyle. But it's been cropping up a lot on the theater profiles as a stage adaptation. So it's interesting. It's the third novel that includes Sherlock Holmes, and it is about this mysterious case of a very large hound in Devonshire, England, who has been haunting a family known as the Baskervilles, and they inhabit this estate, and generation after generation, the title holder of the Baskerville estate has been killed by this hound. So it just goes on, and finally Sherlock solves the case. But now that I've read the novel, I'm very interested to see kind of how this crazy mystery is adapted for the stage. So something to look out for.
But where is it playing this season?
So The Hound of Baskervilles is currently playing at Actors Co-op Theater in Hollywood. It's coming to Philadelphia Theater Company and Portland Stage in the next coming months. There is one version written by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and then there is Ken Ludwig's Baskerville, a Sherlock Holmes mystery that has also been making its rounds.
I feel like one of these days we should probably write a trend piece about Sherlock Holmes adaptations.
Maybe. Didn't we have one in the works for a while?
I have no idea. Then again, I don't enjoy mysteries.
And I'll close this out. I saw two plays recently, both kind of which dealt with the supernatural, which I think will be a topic of another podcast recording. But I recommend both of them. One of them is the Stephen Karam's The Humans, which started at American Theater Company in Chicago. And I think we forgot to mention with here that it started at Magic Theater in San Francisco. So both plays that have come from the regions to New York. The Humans is, you know, as Deep says, her least favorite thing, a living room family drama about middle-class white people complaining about money. But it's very good, and I know our editor-in-chief, Rob, wants to talk more about it, so maybe we'll have a discussion of it at a later podcast. But
it's going to Broadway.
And it's going to Broadway, yeah. And there's some supernatural aspects of it, which are kind of metaphorical. And then another play that I saw recently that I really enjoyed that was a stunning production was Thérèse Raquin at Roundabout. And that also is based on the Emile Zola novel. Helen Edmondson adapted it and stars Keira Knightley in her Broadway debut. And it's a beautiful production that has a lot of supernatural elements. I had trouble sleeping after I saw it, so maybe bring a friend or don't go if you live alone. But yeah, it's stunning. Some great stage pictures, great production, and yeah, so if you like ghosts and creepiness while also getting, you know, historical Emile Zola novels and a good old middle-class American living room play, then The Humans and Thérèse Raquin are... And they're both from Roundabout. I guess I didn't even realize that. They're both Roundabout shows, so go Roundabout.
And Rob knew we were recording today, so he wanted to chime in from space with a recommendation of his own, which is Marc Maron's podcast episode interview with Annie Baker. So that's a fun interview, so check that out. And you can find the links to the things we talked about on AmericanTheater.org and review us on iTunes so that it helps you find us more easily. Thank you all for listening to this episode of Off Script, and we will see you next time.